Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. George Saunders has built a body of work animated by a central tension, the pull between kindness and accountability. Across short stories, essays, and his Booker Prize-winning novel Lincoln in the Bardo, he has explored how ordinary people navigate moral responsibility inside of powerful systems. That inquiry drives his new novel, Vigil. At its center is Jill Dahl Blaine, an afterlife usher tasked with helping the dying shed regret before death. Jill has done this some 343 times. She believes in mercy, she believes in the process, but when she arrives at the lavish estate of K.J. Boone, an oil magnate nearing the end of his life, those beliefs are tested. Boone is wealthy, influential, and seemingly without shame. As the vigil stretches through the night, Jill's practiced routine is interrupted by spectral visitors, ethical challenges, and the strange counterpoint of a wedding celebration happening next door. Vigil asks whether peace is something granted freely or something that requires reckoning first. He is one of my favorite authors. He is one of my favorite guests. And it is a great pleasure to welcome George Saunders back to this week's book show.
It's always good to be back with you. I feel like I'm coming home a little bit.
It is wonderful to have you here to talk about your work. Give us a sense of how this particular work of fiction came about, and if there was any crossover between a feeling of a natural progression from previous work, or was this a very alone idea?
I think it was kind of a convergence of different things. One was there was a series of terrible weather events, maybe two and a half, three years ago. And I just thought it was almost comical because it was such a poster for climate change, you know, the reality of it. And I just thought I found myself thinking about somebody a little older than me who maybe had participated in all that denial that was such a major thing in the 90s. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. That person's getting close to the end of his life. I wonder if this... You know, I wonder, does he watch the news, you know? And if he does watch the news, he's probably a scientist. So doesn't it occur to him that he was wrong? And if it did occur to him that he was wrong, what would that do or not do? You know, just kind of that sort of thought experiment. And so usually when I have that kind of feeling, I just start trying to specify, like, okay, well, who is he? What part did he play? Are we talking about the last week of his life, the last night? Anyway, so it all sort of came out of that. And usually when I'm working through that, I'm kind of anxious to disqualify it. I don't necessarily want to do it, especially if it's a bad idea. I had a writing teacher who told me once, if a young writer could distinguish between the stories he thinks he should write and the stories he actually should write, he'd save himself about 20 years of error. So I was just kind of watching the idea and seeing if it, you know, made me a little giddy. And at one point I thought, oh, that would be fun. And so then I just launched in.
When you came to the idea of the older person and what they had been through, in this novel, we're looking at the last several hours of his life.
Yeah.
But you also use that as a way that allows you to not to cliche it too much, but to have his life flash before his eyes.
Yes, that's right. I also, technically, I'm still kind of a beginner novelist. So for me to set as I did in Lincoln and the Bardo, a really tight little window, it's one night, then I can kind of deal with it. If you say, write a sweeping epic novel over four generations, I'm like, I have no idea how to do that. So somehow it's almost like if someone said, okay, you're a beginning songwriter, just write 1 minute of something, you know, then I feel I can kind of approach it with a little bit of confidence. And to me, like that, the last few minutes, I was thinking of, you know, the death of Ivan Illich by Tolstoy. Mm-hmm. And of course, A Christmas Carol is kind of sort of hints at that. And so I just thought it was something like almost like a little bit of stone I could take and then sort of polish, you know.
He is visited by Jill. Now tell us about Jill, because this man who... we will talk about it in a second, but this man is Jill's charge. That's the word you use to describe what he is to her charge. So what does that mean in this sense?
Well, that's kind of her terminology, and she died quite young, way back in 1976, when I was at my junior prom, I guess, and she had an experience at her death that kind of put her into this suspended state, and so sh her kind of the mission, her mission as she understands it, is to flit around from deathbed to deathbed, essentially, and in that. Those few hours before someone's death, she's sort of like, I guess, a guardian angel of sorts. At least she sees herself that way. So she's going to come down and sit beside you and kind of talk you through those last hours so you don't panic, essentially. That's how she understands her mission.
Almost like a celestial hospice.
Yes. Or like a death doula who's already dead.
Yes, right. To help in the passing. And what I guess surprises her and maybe even surprises us, the readers, is that she's been doing this a long time, 300 plus charges that she has dealt with, and then she comes to meet this guy, and oh, he's kind of a jerk.
And I think part of the trajectory of the book is her figuring out just how much of a jerk, because she's died in 1976, and she has a sort of a limited understanding of what's happened since, and also she has a viewpoint that she got at the moment of her death that's, let's just say, it's very generous, and so
Yes.
she's not interested in saying, Joe, here's what you did wrong. She's kind of saying, whatever you were, how could you have been anything else? Don't worry about it. Just leave that person you were behind and go on. So that's the viewpoint that she sort of acquired at her own death.
KJ Boone is the charge, the latest charge for Jill Blaine. And he is really sort of reveling in his accomplishments. He is not ready to find peace or reckoning with what he has done and the error of his ways. He is quite steady in his belief that what he did was right.
Yes, and I mean, I kind of modeled him on myself. I mean, if you have spent a life doing something you like, and he has, and you along the way you've been kind of bolstering yourself by narratives about why you're doing it and why it's important and how fun it is to be good at. My sense as I worked through the book was that it would be pretty hard to jettison those feelings. From a distance you can say he did wrong, but from inside the prism of his own mind, he was doing great. And also, he had a lot of enemies, some people who, like me, who would have opposed him. But, as we know, if somebody, shouts at you enough, you start to harden against them, and that convinces you that you're even more right. So, one of the really fun things about this book, was that the point of view, having his point of view, made it kind of difficult for me to signal to you, the reader, what I think of this guy. And I don't think very highly of him. And if you kind of went through the book and detail the things he did, he's kind of monstrous. He did a lot of really
Right.
bad things, but of course, from his point of view, he's winning. So that was an interesting reveal of the book, as I, you know, you, I'm sort of not a believer in the Cruella de Vil school of evil, which is that an evil person wakes up in the morning and goes, I'm off to do evil. I think it's more, unfortunately, it's more complicated than that. And a person who's doing bad things wakes up feeling pretty good. I'm going to go out and do my thing.
Rather early in the novel. We meet one of Jill's colleagues, if you will, and you refer to all of these people of her ilk, which
Right.
I thought was an interesting way of describing those who do what Jill does.
Yeah, because I had the feeling that if I kick off today and I become trapped in an afterlife, I don't think I would go, oh, I'm a ghost, because I'm not. I don't have a white sheet. I'm not Casper-like.
Yeah.
I'm me, but I'm feeling different. And so, kind of like in Lincoln of the Bardo, she knows that she's dead, but she feels very special in that state. And she feels not so bad about it. So I think, to say he's of my ilk is her way of saying, dear reader, you don't know what I am. I'm something different than you're imagining.
So of that ilk, in comes the Frenchman, and oh my goodness, this is it was very comical. It's just amusing and lovely. But this character is just sort of wild-eyed and is interesting both to, well, of course, the reader, but to Jill as to he's trying to tell her just how horrible this person is, and. she doesn't quite know what to make of it because of his manic style.
And also, he, you know, I imagine him not exactly getting it either. He's kind of compiling data. And, you know, as he says in the book, he has to first learn the languages of all these different countries. You know, he's a man who died in, I think, 1888 or something. So he doesn't understand the contemporary world. So in a certain way, they are colleagues, as you said, and they're trying to put together the story of this K.J. Boone guy, but both in their own flavor is a little inept. So they're, you know, the book is kind of the story of the two of them struggling to put this narrative together. And also the Frenchman has maybe a more tough love kind of idea. Like, you got to strip this guy down to nothing and, you know, humiliate him and list his misdeeds and be rough with him. And then maybe he can be comforted in some way if you, you know, if you straighten him out and make him face reality. And Jill has a different approach.
The name of the novel is Vigil. George Saunders is the author. It is published by Random House. Many years ago, if I had asked you what type of books you were going to write, or especially novels, would you have said ghost stories?
No. I was going to write Hemingway and I go trout fishing, and you know, and I didn't quite get to those. No, I mean, that's been, you know, in some ways, Joe, that's been the great lesson of my artistic life, which I'm trying to get to bleed out into my real life, which is, you know, we think we know, but we don't know. And in the case of writing, you just have to go where the energy leads you. Meaning, if I can write something that captivates a reader or amuses her or whatever, that's what I have to do. And that's who I really am, as opposed to, you know, me and Ernest down on the river. So one of the things you do as a writer is you kind of sound your own work and say, okay, in this mode, am I offering anything to a reader? Is there any energy here? And if not, you sort of have to let it go, you know? And then when you do find something that is energized, you might not like it that much. I mean, you might not, it might not flatter your view of yourself, but you sort of have to go where the energy is. You know, I always say, like, if you were a ponderous young man who wanted to write string quartets a la Shostakovich, and when you did, everybody went to sleep or walked out of the auditorium, well, that's a message. But then if you pick up your accordion and play a polka, everybody starts dancing. Guess what? You know, you're a polka player.
Your descriptions are amazing. There are no chapters to this novel. It is one long idea, as you say, of those several hours. I assume very conscious, because it puts you in that time of just one thing leading to another, batting off of another. Suddenly we're here, suddenly we're there, we're visiting a wedding, we're going off and talking to somebody who is miles and miles away.
Yeah. I really, I'm noticing one thing I really value is wildness. Well, wildness with a purpose, because to me, that feeling of something being slightly unhinged, but still cohering, is pretty much my autobiography. I mean, I think life is, you know, I mean, we want it to be orderly and we want to be in control of it and we want to be always positive. But, you know, it just doesn't really happen that way. And I think the glimpses that we have of orderliness are kind of illusory. I mean, we can sort of put the costume of order on for a few hours, but then if the world decides to shake us up, the costume comes off. So I love to get that quality in my work, you know, which for me means being funny, being fast, having the kind of quality that you're talking about in the structure, where we're maybe a little bit disoriented. And that's all kind of the closest I've come to expressing the way life actually feels to me, I'd say.
Right next to where all of this is happening, there is a wedding. And
of course there is.
Yes. Yeah. The wedding and the funeral.
Yeah.
And the idea of Jill sort of, and I use the word intentionally, but flitting over to that and back. What was significant in that for you of looking at really, in because you describe it a couple of different ways, but it's essentially peering over the fence.
Mm-hmm. Yes. You know, you asked earlier about the origins of the book, and Paul and I took a trip to Mantua years ago, and there's a palace, I think it's called Poe, Palace of Poe or something like that. But mm-hmm. It was a place that a prince built basically as a pleasure palace, and so he could entertain his mistress. And we walked through there, and it just made me think, excuse me, it made me think about that idea of, of trying to represent lushness, you know, like great food and overflow and celebration and that kind of mode where people are in control of their lives, and they're using it to make a big demonstration of positive phenomenon. So I thought that would be fun to just put that next door. I didn't really know why when I first did it, except maybe just for variety. You know, you sit by a deathbed for only so long. And then as it developed, it became kind of something more, which was a place that was a big distraction for her because she's dead. She's a very serious spirit. When she died, she got this kind of lofty language and lofty worldview. And then she looks over and they're serving the prime rib, you know, and suddenly she's like, oh, boy, I remember that, you know. And so it was that was turned out to be one of the real animating things in the book was that split that she has between I'm so happy I'm essentially an angel and then, oh, man, I wish I was a person again.
The idea of sort of the rules, I assume, that you set for yourself of the language and how you're going to the vocabulary of how you're going to refer to certain things. What was it that you decide that, okay, well, there is going to be a God and there's going to be a heaven and there are angels and there is going to be that really what appears a Christian place?
Yeah. Well, I mean, for me, it always develops at speed. I try not to have any notions before I start. And then as you're trying to write a scene and make it funny or make it lively, the characters or the narrative will blurt something out. So at one point she said something like, but I'm elevated.
Yes.
And I didn't know what it meant. I liked the way it looked on the page. And I was, oh, you are? Well, okay, tell me more. So that's how you kind of do the world building part is you let the characters say, God knows where it comes from, but they say something that you didn't plan for them to say. And then your job is not to delete it, but to go, huh, okay. I mean, just like with a friendship, you say, I didn't know that about you. I did not know that you know, were once a rodeo clown. All right. You know, I'm not going to say that you weren't. I'm going to, okay, tell me more. So that's, for me, the way that these worlds get built most authentically is if I don't have any rules at the start. Except maybe vaguely, you know, I have my Catholic upbringing. And then I just let them tell me, really, you know. And so what that does is, in this one, I felt like this was a more, a wilder afterlife than Lincoln and the Bardo. Lincoln and the Bardo, the book says, yeah, when these people realize they're dead, they go somewhere and they get judged. And maybe they get judged in their own, per their own religion, you know. But in this one, I'm not really quite sure what happens. You know, it's a little, it feels to me like a little more of a wild bar, you know, or something like that. There's a lot of wild energy.
It's not an orderly death.
That's exactly right. Yeah, no, terrifyingly so. Yeah. You know, one of the things I've read in Buddhism is that they say that the mind, in your everyday life, your mind is like a wild horse tethered to a fence. So it's wild and it's bucking and it's moving, but it can only go so far. But then this teaching says when you die, the rope gets cut. The mind is now a wild horse with no tethering whatsoever. So I think some of that is reflected in this book. There's the rules are kind of come and go. And there's a quality of, as you say, of that manic quality was really important to me.
The rules come and go. I love that. So even for you, that you have an idea of what you want to do, but if it's better for the story and better for you, then go with that.
100%. And sometimes it's annoying because something will happen and you're kind of like, look, to your book, you say you're breaking the rules that we've established. And the book kind of says, well, trust me, you just let this stay like this for a few months, and then I'll tell you why it's happening. So that becomes kind of the technical part is to solve the problems that you set up, you know, within the book. And that takes a little bit of patience. The book has to be, well, speaking of disorderly, it has to be a little misshapen for many months. And you have the faith that it'll resolve into something that coheres in some way.
My favorite sentence in the book, Jill is going home for a moment and visiting her former wife and her husband, and sees the TV and says, TV, goodness, TV, television. Gosh, yes, the bright-colored, balloon-lettered Marcus Welby Bandstand Laugh-In Flip Wilson Bob Hope Shindig Thrill of It All, ours, our TV, our set in my childhood, sat just so on a cute Asian table Dad had brought back duty-free from Manila. Hoo boy.
You read that really well.
I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a big kind of a breakthrough sentence, because all along she's kind of telling us that she would rather be alive. And then suddenly these memories are kind of almost like seeping in through this dam she's made. And with that one, she just couldn't help celebrating it. And of course, you know, it's I just remember that in my own childhood of, you know, that when TV was new and you were so cool to be included in it. And yeah. Well, thanks for noticing that.
Very fun. You also, in that, it reminded me that where that last part where it said Dad had brought back duty free from Manila, the apostrophe D in dadded. You use that quite a bit in the novel. I was interested in how that came about.
I'm not even aware that I did that, but I think I like, I'm a real, at some level, I'm a minimalist, and I like you say dadded. I mean, that's how I say it.
Yeah.
Dad had known all along. So if I can get away with that. The other thing I was trying to do there was, you know, she speaks in two very distinct argots. You know, she's got a very elevated, almost 19th century diction, and she's got kind of just vernacular. So anything I could do to let you know that we were in the lower argot, I would do. So even down to the level of punctuation like that.
I feel bad that it's this late in the interview and I haven't made this point. Which is that it's hilarious. The novel is hilarious. It's so fun, and the humor and the wit is something that stays throughout. I mean, that is a hallmark of your work, but especially in a book like this, it just seems fun.
I would put that on the cover of the book. It just seems fun. That would be because you know, behind that idea, there's a whole lot of other things that you know. At this, you know, at my 800th year now as a writer, the one thing I really value is that, well, that, you know, the fact that you sat there and read the book and found it fun, that means so much to me. And behind that is a whole bunch of ideas about connection. I mean, you and I, we know each other, you know, through this context, but
yes,
but if you're laughing at what I'm writing, we're connecting in a really deep way that says basically at some profound depth, we see the world in the same way. You can't get somebody to laugh if you're in opposition or if somehow your worldviews aren't lining up. So I've come to see that entertainment function as the most important thing, not as an evasion of meaning, but as the best way to get meaning. You know, if you laugh at something, that means that you and I have been walking along the same path and I pointed something out that you've already noticed. I think more and more that connection is kind of it's what I love about fiction. And I think you could make the case, which I have at length, but you know, that's part of what's being eroded in contemporary life, that sense of connection by which we understand, oh, we are all in this together. And even somebody who I don't know very well, or even somebody I'm in opposition to, there are places where the paths converge, and there's a lot of positive value spending some time on those, you know, mutual paths.
And not to get all Dr. Joy's brothers on you, but it does seem as though what you just described of me laughing, you writing about this, that there is that commonality that we have. But you're exploring this with characters who are looking at Boone in whether it's the daughter or a friend or a former worker and they're not on that plane. They're not at that place. They're trying to find it in his last hours, but they're not there.
Right. And that happens as well. You know, so I think part of it is I think the book, and particularly Jill, she models the aspiration to understand and forgive other people. The Frenchman is the other way. He's like, no, we're living in an actual world here.
Yeah.
If you do harm, I need to call you on it. And so for me, the fun of this book, and I think it's maybe new in my work, I'm not sure, but I feel like it is. It felt like I was living into that Chekhovian idea that a work of art doesn't have to solve a problem. It just has to formulate it correctly. So then the writer is kind of the band leader going, Jill, tell us your view and do it as well as you can. Okay, now stop. Frenchman, you tell me your view. K.J. Boone, even you get a chance, you know. So then the book hopefully is kind of a collection of these viewpoints each of which has been presented at its highest register. And so then it's sort of, I think, an imitation of an attempt at a God's eye view of all of us. You know, what does it look like from inside these five different people, six different people? And then in a certain way, the writer at the end just goes, thus it is. You know,
Yes.
he doesn't put his finger on the scale, but he says, isn't it complicated? Wow, you know, go forth and be confused. But I think that state of complication is actually a fairly high, it's high on the ladder of human consciousness to be so full of truth, contradictory truths, that you're a little paralyzed is kind of okay, I think. We don't, I would say, I personally don't spend enough time in that state. I always know. But when I'm reading a work of fiction, I often can get in a place where I'm like, oh yeah, my mind actually isn't vast enough to really understand anything. I have to. I sometimes have to. I have to make choices. But how nice is it to just stay in that realm of ambiguity for just a couple minutes a day, just to remind yourself that your mind has limitations.
And you leave us with the characters, and you leave us with their fate, if you will. But you also leave us with the understanding of this huge problem that we continue to deal with climate change, and that there are people like K.J. Boone who are responsible or partially responsible for it, and gives us the question, which seems like these days we're dealing with almost daily, of okay, well, now what do we do about it?
This is where a novel is limited in that way. You know, I mean, I could write a great screed on what we should do about it, although at
Yeah.
this point I'm not really sure actually. But the novel, I think, exists in a kind of a different space, so that it allows us to look at true criminals. Now, I don't know whether K.J. Boone is a criminal, but let's say he is. Okay, so I'm now, right now, I have my novelist hat on. How do I look at a true criminal? And I think that the form tells you have to look at it with specificity. That's the first thing. And you have to be true to point of view, you know? So I don't know. I mean, I think my working hypothesis, which is being tested every day, is that if we have interest in other people, even people who are really bad people, then we're better equipped to deal with them.
George Saunders's latest is Vigil. It is published by Random House. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LaDuke. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.